Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
You boldly go where no man has gone before.
Engage.
Engage. Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure, history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. My name is Jordan Hoffman. Thank you once again for listening. It is anniversary week. September 8th, 1966 was the day, star date, when the denizens of Sol 3 on this planet we call Earth could fire up their television sets and watch The Man Trap, the first episode of Star Trek ever to air. Not the first shot. Not the second shot, not the third shot, but it was the first one that aired for a bunch of complicated production reasons and studio marketing reasons, and that was the one that came on first. So today we're going to do a deep dive just on that. We have other stuff happening here for anniversary week, but we're going to do a deep dive just on The Man Trap, which I just recently watched, and there's someone at my door. There's someone at the door right now. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dave Schilling to the podcast. Dave Schilling, everybody.
Hello. Wow. Not only did I get a chime from Next Generation, I got a clap.
Yep. So for those of you who don't know the internet's Dave Schilling, Dave is a writer who currently, his official title is writer at large, and he is large. He's large and in charge. Dave Schilling is writer at large at The Guardian, which happens to be the same outfit where I write my movie reviews. Prior to The Guardian, Dave worked for Grantland, may it rest in peace. You are our second former Grantlander on the show.
Oh, who is number one?
We had Matt Patches on.
Oh, Patches. I like Patches.
So
he's good.
He's a good guy. Prior to Grantland, you worked at Vice.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, you wrote, elsewhere. You've written for a lot of places.
Prior to that, I was in college.
Right.
Prior to that, I was in high school.
Right. And prior to that, you were just watching Star Trek.
Exactly, yes.
In your living room.
The rest of my life before high school was just watching Star Trek.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you here. And, you write about culture. You write about sports in the past. You write about important topics. But one need not peek too much beneath the hood to discover that you are a big raging nerd. I mean, this
yes.
is not a secret.
No.
It's
no.
pretty evident that you are one who incorporates nerd topics into your discussions of important political themes, social themes, and the other, you know, good work that you do. But you also write a lot about Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Marvel Comics, the whole thing.
Yes.
So where does Star Trek fit in for you in the pantheon? And be honest.
Star Trek is number one.
Really?
Star Trek was the first thing that I was excited about as a child. Because it was one of my father's favorite shows. So when it was on Channel 40 in Sacramento, which was the only TV station close to my hometown called Merced in California, we would watch Star Trek. And in my parents' bedroom, we'd sit around the TV and talk about it. I remember Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and 2 and how that was a topic of conversation in our house for the 3 or 4 months before it came back.
Did you think Picard was going to get killed?
Yeah.
I
had no reason to assume. I didn't know anything about the contract negotiations or whatever was going on at the time with Next Generation. I just knew that my hero had been assimilated by the Borg and Riker was taking over, and I didn't know who this Shelby character was. She's a little shady. And yeah, it's my number one favorite thing. It still is.
Awesome.
My wife is constantly perplexed by all the toys I have in our house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have a Star Trek room, or does it
I don't. I have an office.
You have an office,
and that office has a lot of Star Trek memorabilia. Yeah. I have Enterprise D and the Kelvin Timeline Enterprise, and I've got a motion picture poster, bunch of stuff.
The Bob Peak. That's the best one.
It's amazing, and then they did the sort of take on it.
Oh, yeah.
For Beyond. It's great.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, we've talked about the Bob Peak poster a lot, and. It's funny, best of both worlds. I just, earlier today, we're banking this episode, we just had Professor David Greer, not David Allen Greer,
sure.
Professor David Greer of New York University, who is creating and has created the first functional tractor beams. This is real. He's created, I mean, they move microscopic photons,
sure.
But they work. And we were talking about his favorite episodes, because he's a big Trek nerd, and he was like, it was the death of Lieutenant Yar that did it for me.
Yeah.
And that, the reason I bring that up is because when I saw Best of Both Worlds 1 and then had to wait that summer, I was convinced that Picard was dead because Star Trek killed characters.
Yeah.
Because I loved Lieutenant Yar at first. I was also 13 and she was blonde, so I'm like, yeah, okay, Lieutenant Yar. And then they killed her, and I'm like, I remember sitting in my grandmother's kitchen watching it. It's like, yeah, and when does she wake up? And like, now we're at the funeral. Like, yeah. And when does Lieutenant Yar come back? So that stayed with me. So Best of Both Worlds, that summer, I was like, he's dead, get over it. Picard said, Riker said, fire, and then we cut to black. Nothing they can do.
It's really one of the most brilliant pieces of television.
It is.
Ever been.
It's so great. It yeah. really is a lot of fun. So is Next Gen your favorite of the series?
Yes, just because that was what I grew up with. You know,
yeah.
I was, I remember watching Next Generation when my brother was born. My brother's
oh,
4
wow.
years younger than me. I'm 32. He's, what would that be, 28? And we debate as to which episode it was, because I remember it being Shades of Grey for some reason, but he's like, I was born on April 4th, 1988, so it couldn't be Shades of Grey. It was probably, what was it?
I could look it up for you right now.
Yeah, look it up.
Should I? I mean, I hope for your sake it's not Shades of Grey, because Shades of Grey
is not a great episode.
Is a stinker. But let me go to Memory Alpha. Do, 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 do. And you could just do it by the date. So, of course, the Wi-Fi here on Deck 44 here is the worst. But
when do I get my Synthahol?
When do you get your Synthahol? Okay, so I'm just going to do a Shades of Grey, because we think it's near Shades of Grey. So Shades of Grey episode was aired on beep 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 beep. Oh, we're so close. This is what happens on Star Trek. You like it. So that aired on, no, Shades of Grey was July 17th, 1989.
So I'm not remembering it well. Yeah, it was. So it was the season before. It was
season one.
Well, see, it was season one. So you know what it probably was. It's probably the Neutral Zone, or it was Conspiracy.
Oh, I hope it was Conspiracy.
Because that was toward the end yeah. of the first season.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Conspiracy was the one that I knew, and that others... I had very few friends that liked Trek at that time, or admitted to liking it. But that was the one that some of the Trek ambivalent ones were like, all right, this show is righteous. Because they blew up a dude's head.
It was the most graphic episode. It's a show that was really never... It was never about anything gruesome and like... Some of the strangest aliens ended up being benevolent for some reason.
Yeah.
But it's like a gigantic, like, lizard, not a lizard, but like a pink creature.
A neural parasite.
And they blow it up.
They blow it up like scanners. The guy's head just, like, it pops, and he's sitting in a chair, and it's revolting to this day. It's the single most revolting thing in all of Trek lore.
Yeah.
Except for the episode and the Children Shall Lead, which is just grotesque in general. But... it's uncommon, and that was the one that got. There was this one kid who was older than me, and he didn't tease me, but he didn't like me.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was 1 year old and just thought I was a putz. But I remember hearing him say to another kid, "Did you see Star Trek?" And the other one's like, "No, I don't watch Star Trek." He's like, "Dude, this episode was crazy. They blew this guy up." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, all right. This is bringing in we talk about bringing in diverse audiences to Star Trek. This was bringing in the goons. This was bringing in the horror goons. So, you know, that was pretty cool. So that's Conspiracy. But the first episode that ever aired, September 8th, 1966, The Man Trap, is kind of weird because When one go, you know, people come to Star Trek through all different avenues. A lot of different on-ramps to Star Trek right now. There are the new movies. There's going to be the new show in January. People just knew, you know, Next Gen, and they go, okay, maybe I should watch the original series. They watch Wrath of Khan, and they go, okay, I'm going to watch the old-fashioned Kirk, Spock, Bones. Let's see it. And the first episode, for all intents and purposes, and the one that makes sense, is the one called Where No Man Has Gone Before, which was the, as most people listening know, was the second pilot that was shot. The first pilot, The Cage, had a different captain, had Captain Pike, not Captain Kirk. That footage was later, as we say on the internet, was aggregated content that was then repackaged and reused in the menagerie. But, you know, Where No Man Has Gone Before is a pretty good first episode. You get to see everybody. And then, of course, they made some further tweaks for the next episode that was shot, which is the Corbomite Maneuver, which is one of my personal favorites, probably in my top three, and is really a great first one. The way it was shot, Joseph Sargent, the director, who later made the Taking the Pelham 1, 2, 3, had some very innovative camera movement. It's just a great, you know, nail-biter of a show. And it's the first one with the cast we love. Dr. McCoy, because McCoy's not in where No Man Has Gone Before. And everybody's wearing the right color outfit.
Except for Uhura, who's
gold. She's wearing gold in that one, and that was a boo-boo. And they just screwed up. They just didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
But anyhow, Mantrap was filmed a couple episodes later, but because it didn't have such complex special effects as Corbomite Maneuver, they could get it on the air sooner. Corbomite Maneuver was supposed to be the first one. And Where No Man Was Going For was by the suits was deemed not right for the first one because of story reasons. So they had a few others that could go first, and they picked Mantrap. Do you think Mantrap was a good way to go? Does it make sense as a first episode?
Well, I think one of the stranger things about Corbomite Maneuver, to go back to that, is there's a big part for a crew member who is not a regular cast member.
Right.
And so that's sort of like you keep expecting him to keep showing up, and he doesn't. He sort of disappears. What is that character's name? I was gonna just avoid it, but
no, it's
we're gonna get nasty emails.
I have long established myself as the guy who sometimes forgets people's names. You know, he's an important guy, and you know he's left.
And he has the big character arc in that episode.
Yeah, he has the big character arc. Bailey.
Bailey, yes, yeah. Lieutenant Bailey, or Ensign Bailey. You know, he starts off being very xenophobic and then comes to understand alien culture.
He reps Star Trek so well. He reps, like, you know, understanding the ethos of Roddenberry, which is like, you know, don't fear what you don't understand, embrace it, and knowledge and diversity and all these good topics that we love in Star Trek. You're right. He never comes back. Yeah. He's on the Theseus with Clint Howard drinking grapefruit juice.
Right, Tranya.
And Tranya.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was supposed to be orange juice, but they made Clint Howard drink grapefruit juice, and he was like a little kid.
Yeah.
He was 8, and he hated it. He was miserable. He was crying because it was his first job. The Howard family was a Hollywood family, so the dad, you know, all the kids were working, the dad. And he got the gig wearing those weird eyebrows. And they're like, you drink grapefruit juice, kid. And he's like, I don't want to drink grapefruit juice. Leave me alone. And his father's like, you will drink grapefruit juice.
You're a professional actor. But Mantrap is interesting because at least it's, you know, the character arc is for McCoy. It's about McCoy getting over Crater and accepting that she's not alive anymore, that even though this alien looks like his former flame, it's not her.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting theme that recurs on Star Trek is, like, are you going to be able to kill the woman that you love?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it comes back in City on the Edge of Forever.
Sure.
Where Kirk's got to push, it's happening again.
Edith Keeler.
Has to not push her.
Has to abstain from taking action.
Right. To let her die.
Let time move the way it ought
to. Exactly. Because otherwise Hitler will take her. I love that she is the reason why
she really is. We
won World War II.
She is. She. It all comes down to Joan Collins in that soup kitchen. You know, if it hadn't been for her, there would be problems.
Yeah. But what do you think about Mantrap?
Well, you know, it's watching it again as I did yesterday. There's just a lot of things that are interesting about it. I don't think it's the best episode, but I don't think it's bad. I think it's a solid episode. It does get a little dull in the middle because it's just ultimately is this monster's running around pretending to be other creatures. But one of the two things I really like about it, one is that so much of what I love about Star Trek in general is just thinking of like what's an average day on the Enterprise like. You know, one of my favorite episodes is the Lower Decks.
Yeah.
From TNG. And this is like has a little bit of like day in the life of the Enterprise. You know, Janice Rand bringing Sulu a salad, you know, like and just hanging out. So you get to see a lot of that. And that, I think, is great. But the other thing I love to think about is to try to put yourself in the headspace of somebody watching Star Trek for the first time in 1966. And what are the first things you're seeing? So the very first image is the ship orbiting a planet. So cool, special effect shot, looks great. Cut to the bridge. You got Spock in the center seat.
Yep.
Looking like a weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
If it's 1966 and you don't know anything about the show other than the name, and then you see pointy-eared Spock, you're like, what the hell's going on there? Who is this guy? And he doesn't say a word. And then you've got Lieutenant Leslie there, who was not an unimportant extra guy, and then you have Uhura in the shot. And then you hear a voiceover of Captain's Log, and then you cut away, and you don't go back to the ship for, like, two commercials.
Right.
So it's pretty weird. You're like, imagine you're a kid. Imagine you're 12 years old. New show's on Star Trek. You're hearing about it. Sci-fi show. You turn it on. You'd be like, who the hell's that guy?
Yeah.
Get back on the ship. What did I just see? And then you cut down, and it's like, you know, Kirk is at his most, like, you know, Major Don West. Hi, I'm, you know, he's making jokes with McCoy about women and stuff. It's a little bit, you know, there are some, as we say, problematic stuff in original Star Trek. It is very progressive, but it is still 1966, and there's a lot of sexism, I think is the word I'm looking for. Yeah. And this episode leans on that quite a bit from the get-go. You got Kirk, you got McCoy talking about ladies, you got that other third dude. They start talking about Wrigley's pleasure planet.
Yep.
So the opening is pretty strange. And then like they play like the saucy music. So they meet Dr. Crater. And she appears to McCoy as the beautiful young woman. She appears to Kirk as an older woman, as Kirk calls her, a handsome woman, you know, yeah. But she's older.
She's handsome, but she's definitely older.
Yeah. You know, a little gray in her hair.
Yeah.
And then she appears to the first guy who's going to get killed. He's not wearing a red shirt, but he is a red shirt. And she's like dishy, blonde, and they play like the sassy music as she walks away. It goes like, wah, wah, wah. And then it cuts to commercial.
Yeah.
So it cuts to the intro. So the first stuff you're ever seeing about Star Trek is like first image is like this crazy elven creature, a black woman on the crew, mm-hmm. which for 1966 is just
unheard of.
Yeah. And then third dude. And then you don't see those guys again. And then it's like the Playboy Club downstairs. They're like, we're talking about dishy women. And then you cut to commercial. It's a hell of a way to start the show, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like, at the time, television writers and networks and producers accepted that you just were going to go along with it. It seems like now today there's more expository dialogue to make sure that you are centered into the universe when you watch a pilot.
Yes.
This first episode of Star Trek is like, okay, well, there's a spaceship and there's an alien and go.
Yeah,
that's it. It's like there's no time for you to understand it.
And had they gone with Where No Man Has Gone Before, there isn't much more expository. The Cage did have that scene with Pike and his doctor, Boyce.
Mm-hmm.
Boyce was the second one. Piper was his doctor.
Yeah, Dr. Piper.
Who he called Bones.
Mm-hmm.
There's that sort of like, Doc.
Boyce was the first one.
You're right. So there's the scene with Boyce and Pike when they chat in his chambers that does act as sort of like an intro into the world. But there's none of that here. But then what I love is, and I'd kind of forgotten this until I watched it again recently, is you have some more going on down at the planet. Then you meet, you know, the guy who's doing the research on the planet, who's like, "Go away! I don't want to deal with you." And then McCoy's got to investigate him. He's using a wooden tongue depressor on him, which I think is really cool. He's got the medical tricorder there. He's like, good old fashioned wooden tongue depressor. But then you cut back to the ship, and you have one of the lengthier scenes between Spock and Uhura.
This is an important scene for me on a couple levels. One, you go back to the ship, and it's the weirdest character and a black woman.
Yeah.
And so if you're watching TV and you're a typical 1966 television audience, your brain explodes at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
The second thing is there's a whole nother layer to that scene when you watch the Kelvin movies. Because it's like,
oh shit, yeah.
There's this interesting dynamic between them where she's flirting with him. And
she's
shuts her down.
Yeah.
He does not understand anything about it. And it makes you remember that at the beginning of Star Trek, Leonard Nimoy's performance of Spock, his conception of that character was he really had no emotions. I mean, it came later when I guess he decided that really what he's doing is suppressing them. They exist because he's half human.
Right.
But he tries his damnedest to keep them from coming out.
Right. Which I think later is established that all Vulcans have emotion, but they just tamp it down. But Spock has
he's
more difficulty
tortured. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, he...
And he's mean to her.
He is. He's a bit of a dick. He says... you know, she's like... It's like a day at the office, right?
Yeah.
So she's like, what's... She says... frequencies. Oh, if I have to say the word frequencies one more time, I'm going to go bananas.
And he doesn't understand why.
And he's like,
that's her job.
It is illogical. Why would you? He's given her typical Vulcan stuff, which, again, if you're new to the show and you haven't read any TV guide profiles of what a Vulcan is, you're just like, why is this dude with weird eyebrows and weird ears so nuts about this? It later comes out in the conversation that he comes from a planet with no emotions, but he's being. He's kind of admonishing her, and then she puts it back in his face. She's kind of like a little sassy, like, I'm just trying to make conversation, dude. You know, we're pals. And then it sort of brightens up, and but it goes on for a while. I think
it's a long scene.
I actually have the I have the transcript here because if I hear the word frequency once more, I'll cry. I was just trying to start a conversation. And he says, well, since it is illogical for a communications officer to resent the word frequency, I have no answer. I mean, it's good comedy.
Yeah.
It's good comedy. But yes, I mean, for 1966 and for, you know, there had been no quote unquote smart sci-fi, you know, treatment of aliens in any sort of, I mean, it's silly to say realistic manner because we have yet to meet aliens that I know about,
but well-rounded,
character. It's a really a really cool scene, and you know, it was luck of the draw. Like there weren't that many episodes that had that much Uhura in it,
yeah.
And it was reminded me now, looking back, at how much Uhura was in this first episode, because you know, today people who never watch Star Trek. They still know, it was innovative for its time. Why? I had a black woman on the crew, you know, and she was one of the big stars. Well, most of the time she just kind of sat there and talked on the intercom. But but still, she was, you know, involved in many episodes. And this was one of her biggest shows, in a way.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a dearth of episodes where she goes down on the away team.
Yeah.
I think she's in Bread and Circuses.
Yeah.
I think she's in, she's not in The Apple, is she? She's in some where she goes down to the planet.
Yeah.
For the most part, she's on the headset.
Yeah.
And she's communicating with Starfleet Command, which was, by the way, a concept they had not even come up with yet. If you've read These Are the Voyages,
yeah,
where they go through all of the episodes.
Yeah. Mark Cushman's books.
It's great.
They're those essential reading. They also are, it's like the Silmarillion of Star Trek, because it's just gigantic episode by episode tomes. Like, they're 800 pages each, these
excerpts
books,
of production notes from Roddenberry's desk. It's fascinating stuff. And they're not sure what the superstructure of this universe is yet, which is really crazy. But back to Uhura. She's she's a supporting character. You watch the show, and you're probably going to be surprised if you're a new viewer that there's only two people, and then in the third season, three people in the opening credits. Everybody else is relegated to the end credits because it was Shatner and Nimoy's show.
Yeah.
You think about them as an ensemble. Now,
nowadays, especially.
After the movies.
After the second movie.
Yeah.
Like, Star Trek The Motion Picture, a character like Sulu barely... You know, he has a couple of shots. He gets a couple of good close-ups. Barely has any lines.
His biggest scene in the movie they cut out, that was where he's fumbling around to help Ilea learn how to use the navigation system on the new Enterprise. And he's like, ooh, she's sexual. Right. Because, you know, she's, you know, Deltons are known for their sexuality. And so he's...
My oath of celibacy
is
on
record,
sir.
Captain. Or not, sir. Yeah, Captain. Yeah, she's talking to Kirk. Yeah. But it's just, it's ridiculous. People thinking that this was a show where everybody was an equal character. And that's why Shatner and Nimoy had so much power going into the movies, their ability to kind of like say, I'm going to direct or I'm going to do this or whatever, because they were the stars.
It was. And of course, as the show took off, Spock was the big hit. Spock Mania hit, and Shatner was annoyed. And then he realized, Roddenberry sat him down. He's like, you're the captain. What's good for Star Trek is good for you. So if people love Spock, embrace that because they love Spock opposite you and ride that. And he's like, okay. And that kind of, you know, set him straight. Although, you know, many people think of it not as Kirk Spock, but Kirk Spock Bones.
Yeah.
You know, as a id ego, super ego, you know, as a...
it has to be that. I mean, I think that... that's one of the things that I wanted from Star Trek Beyond that I got was the sense of camaraderie between the three of them.
Yeah.
That it's this trio, and you didn't get that in the first two because it was so focused on the Kirk-Spock friendship.
Yeah.
But Kirk and Spock don't make sense without McCoy to be the third part of the triangle.
I agree, and I think a lot of that comes in the show more. I think that's part of... one of the reasons why people's reaction to the new movie instantly was, oh, this felt so much more like the show, was just because there was more Bones.
Mm-hmm.
And more Bones interacting with Kirk and Spock.
Exactly.
You know?
And but that's not something that you get in this episode as much.
No. And partially because it's a Bones episode, which there aren't too many of.
Right.
There's this, there's Friday's Child, there's For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, which is one of my favorites to say. And those are kind of it, I think, as kind of the Bones.
I think he has a pretty big subplot in Shore Leave, too. Because doesn't he die?
He dies, yeah. And then he comes back with those two ladies on his arms. Yep. Hello. So that one's a lot of fun.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
So another thing that's really funny in this in Mantrap is all right, so they go down to the planet, and then Mr. Redshirt, not wearing red, gets killed. They go, oh, something's going on, and they come back up to the ship, and right before and then one goofy thing happens. Kirk says to Uhura, "Tell Commander Dominguez that his." Space Commander Dominguez says we have supplies that he urgently needs, and then Kirk says, "Tell Jose he'll get his chili peppers when we get there. Tell him they're prime Mexican reds. I handpicked them myself. He won't die if he goes a few more days without them." Got
Space
it.
Space Commander Dominguez.
Right, I mean, I love this because it's something that you have in this episode that you don't have a lot of later, which is kind of a 50s pulp vibe. Sherman's Pleasure Planet, and then giving red peppers to Space Commander Dominguez, which is just so bizarre. You know, the fact that Kirk is flying around with a gift for his buddy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see too much of later. You know, it's a lot of they're all business. A lot of what makes Trek work is that they're the only ship out there.
Yep.
You know, they're not just making routine runs between, you know, space stations and bumping into old pals. So that straight line really jumped out at me when I watched this again.
It did seem like they were setting up more of, I guess, a pirate ship vibe. Not that they were actually pirates, because they were obviously the military, but just like that chummy sort of very masculine idea of like we drink whiskey together and we get each other space chilies and things. And again, that goes back to my point about how they didn't have an idea of what the superstructure of the universe was.
Right.
There was
right.
no real federation yet.
Yes, 100%. This is something that all came in later. I mean, keep in mind, the early episodes were pitched and then written and then crafted by writers before there was really much of a quote-unquote show Bible to show them. So when some of the writers were working, and Harlan Ellison talks about this a lot, there was nothing to see, you know? They had watched The Cage, but when the first ones were put together, they didn't know the sort of the vibe yet. Mm-hmm. And so they were drastically rewritten on the fly by the in-house writers. At this time, John D.F. Black was still on the show. He left midway for a season. DC Fontana then came in, and Roddenberry himself. And Roddenberry had his fingers in a lot of the first season. And this is the episode where the phrase, the great bird of the galaxy, Sulu says that, which was an awful line, and then became his nickname because it was like, give me a break. But then right after the Space Peppers line is where McCoy says, listen, you got to come in the sick bay. And he doesn't even call it sick bay. He calls it the dispensary.
Oh, yeah, the dispensary, right.
Come on in. And I got to tell you something that I don't want to say over the speaker, which also was not very Starfleet. Like, certainly, a next-gen Picard wouldn't exactly broadcast things to all decks if he didn't need to, but he trusted every member of that crew.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like to say something.
There was no paranoia by the 24th century.
True meritocracy. Everybody was there for a reason, even Lieutenant Barclay. I mean, he had his place. So the thing that McCoy has to tell him is, like, you know, all the salt's gone out of this person's body. And I would like to think that anybody watching it already has put the show together. Like, at this point, you know who the bad guy is.
Yeah, it's telegraphed for you. That was the thing about 60s TV is there would always be an extreme close-up. Not extreme, but a close-up of the bad guy and like scary music. Because they did that multiple times with Crater, the female, McCoy's ex, that they would show her and she would look kind of shifty and like, her eyes would darken. It's like, me? No.
Right. So you're like 15, 16, 17 minutes into the show and you know the ending at this point. But you don't know the full, you know that she's the villain. You don't know that she's that creature.
I mean,
that's the real reveal is the ending. I do want to talk about the ending in a moment. But before we do, one thing that is funny is the idea of the salt vampire, of losing your salt instantaneously. What Roddenberry did early on was he commissioned the Rand Corporation to sort of vet the science on the show, and also a company which happens to be called Kellum DeForest Research. Which is funny because of DeForest Kelly. Yeah. But it's called Kellum DeForest Research, and they were hired to just go over the scripts and give it a rubber stamp. So I don't know whether it was Rand. I think Rand was more into, like, you know, when they would talk about like warp bubbles and things like that. But Kellum DeForest Research Company came back and said, yeah, we talked to some doctors, and if all the salt evaporated from your body in an instant, sure, you'd probably die. And they're like, great, it works.
Put it in the episode.
Put it in the episode. That's how it is with the salt vampire. But I got to ask you, so at the end, cut ahead to the end. I love the ending. But there's the big reveal. The salt vampire, the M113 villain, or villainess, if you will, is sucking the salt out of Captain Kirk, very slowly, by the way. Yeah. Everyone else seemed to die instantly, but he took a long time.
And that gave Shatner a lot of time to mug for the camera.
He really did. And he freezes, and then McCoy's got the gun, and then Spock comes in, and he shouts, he's killing him! And then there's the great shot where the woman transforms into the monster, and there's the great, and then transforms back. I ask you, Dave, do you interpret this to mean, A, that when the villain, When the salt vampire is sucking salt, it cannot maintain its illusion and must revert to its original form? Or B, was the salt vampire tired of living? And did the salt vampire want McCoy to see him or her as he truly was to put him out of his misery? It was the last buffalo. It was time to go.
I love that line, too, about she was the buffalo.
Like, was it just like, enough's enough, put me out of my misery? Or was it just guilty? Did the creature feel guilty for leading McCoy on? And so said, I'm going to show myself as I am. What do you think?
Well, by that point, she had... The salt vampire had murdered Dr. Crater, the husband, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so there was nobody left on the planet. The Enterprise crew was going to leave no matter what.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I can see there being a suicidal impulse of, like, just kill me. There's no more of my species here. No one's coming back to this planet. I can't trick anybody anymore. So just do me in. But I think it's more of just an instinct to feed, because she killed Dr. Crater too, and she had been living with him for years at that point, pretending to be his wife. So I think it was just, I need to eat.
And so when it gets in the feeding mode, it just reverts.
It's like a bird of prey.
Right.
Unless it's decloaked.
Yeah. Or it's like you just can't look cool while you're eating.
Yeah.
You know, like to some people, they just look like a slob no matter what they do. So right. That's how it is with the salt vampire. Yeah. Okay. That's a pretty good interpretation. I mean, from a production point of view, it was like, well, we got to see this damn thing. So
that too, yeah. It was a good shot. Final act reveal. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Living with make-believe wives, it was a recurring thread because it happened with the episode with Zefram Cochrane called Metamorphosis, The Cloud. And to a certain extent, this side of paradise, too. They were living in a fantasy realm by the spores, you know, was keeping them there. So, you know, when you got a good idea, bring it back, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably a preoccupation of the primarily male writing staff of Star Trek. This idea of, you know, wives and monogamy and relationships and mortality and... you know, like where do I find women when I'm in space? So why not marry an alien or marry an android?
Yeah,
turn an android into a woman and you know, be married to the android.
Right, and that was just, I guess it was like they were thinking, you know, we're really going to do this. You know, the space race is continuing.
At some point, this is going to happen. We are going to go in space because it was such a there was a futuristic feeling, I would imagine, too, living in the 60s. People are going to the moon, and we're inventing, you know, rockets and all this stuff that's so far beyond the ability to comprehend for someone who lived it at that time.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of, like, I mentioned this sort of saucy music when we see the vision in the pre-title sequence. There's some more of that in this episode, and more so than really a lot of the other episodes. There's a moment where Kirk tells Bones to stop thinking with your glands because Bones is like, I refuse to believe that my love is sucking salt out of people. He's like,
right.
Doctor, stop putting your glands. And then later when Janice Rand is bringing lunch to Sulu, like there's like this shot of like three dudes. Now, one of them is the creature as Ensign so-and-so, but it's like him kind of standing there like a goon. And then these two other dudes are just like just licking their chops over Janice Rand, saying like, "How do you like that?"
The character of Rand, divorced from, you know, all of the issues that Grace Lee Whitney had on the show as it is, but the character itself is a tragic figure to me because she really was the object of derision and constantly lusted over. There's the enemy within where evil Kirk tries to take advantage of her.
Oh, yeah, it's practically
a rape scene in that episode. It's really, like, that's a disturbing scene in that episode. The portrayal of women in Star Trek was not always great.
Yeah, Charlie X, he's smacking her tush. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's not funny, but there was one episode, Conscience of the King, where there were some lines that were in the script that had to be cut out for time, and they were the nicest thing that was ever said about Janice Rand. It was when when Kirk is up on like the observation deck with Caridian's daughter, I forget the character's name, and they're just chatting and they're kind of, you know, getting all romantic, and then Rand is supposed to come by, and she and the woman's supposed to be like, oh, that's your yeoman. And there was a scene where Kirk was supposed to say yes, and she's treated just as equally as any man, or something very like, you know, I don't treat her any different because she's beautiful, and
but that is so not that. True.
It is not true, but it would have been nice to at least give some lip service to that, yeah. And it never even got shot.
We didn't really get to a point where there was true equality of characters on Star Trek, I think, until Deep Space Nine. Because even Next Generation, the concept of Counselor Troi was sort of as a sex kitten at the beginning.
Well, yes. Yes, but not at the end.
Well, yeah, no, they built... I mean, just saying from the beginning.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
Yes.
DS9 really had a far more level playing field at the start.
You're absolutely right, but I think the very concept of a counselor on the ship was like this sort of utopian ideal, but they put her in some wacky costumes, and really she was there to be. And Lieutenant Yar also was, you know, there was that awful episode where she's captured.
Code of Honor,
not really one of the low points.
Fascinating episode though. Like, there are some episodes in that first season of TNG that you go back and you're like, wow, I can't believe that got to the air.
No, Code of Honor's rough.
But I don't think that there's a lot of that in the first season of the original series.
No.
Just to take it back to Mantrap, there's automatic chemistry between everybody on the show. The scenes between all of the principals that you would come to know and love later are mostly in line with who they would be later on in the series. And Kirk and McCoy really have a great rapport straight away. I know this is what the third episode that they had shot.
Yeah.
But if you're watching it, for the first time, you wouldn't know that it was the third episode that they shot, or the first episode.
No, they feel like they've known each other for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Even in that first pre-title sequence when it's just Kirk and McCoy as they're about to go in, the banter there is pretty neat.
But TNG, I think, unlike that, Picard is different. Riker is different.
No, the pilots. Picard's a kind of a jack. He's nasty.
A jerk. Yeah,
and he has his catchphrase is "Now hear this," which you never hear again.
Yep.
He says it like four times. Now hear this, and then it's like
he's constantly barking from the captain's chair into the intercom.
Yeah, no, it's
and Riker is kind of a bore.
Yeah,
though he smiles a lot. It's more of a smirk, like a sarcastic smirk.
Once he grew the beard, it was where he really took off. I mean, pre-beard Riker is
it's a different show.
Yeah, it's a different show. But so Mantrap. A couple other notes. McCoy as the creature, though, DeForest Kelly is great. The way he stands with his arms kind of akimbo a little bit, and he's hovering with this weird look on his face, really spooky. There's some goofy dialogue. It needs love as much as it needs salt. I mean, I could imagine, let's say part of the run-up to Trek was like, this is going to be intelligent sci-fi, and they had a lot of great writers that were involved. You know, Isaac Asimov vouched for the show. So let's say you are someone who is dismissive of television, as many intellectuals were, and maybe a few still are, and you say, all right, I'm going to tune into this new show. It's September 8th, 1966. And you have somebody saying a line like that. You're like, screw this. This is idiotic. So, you know, there's some goofy, pulpy moments in this episode.
People think of Star Trek as very cerebral, and it's not. It's a pulp adventure. It's very accessible. And it's a morality story. It's a morality play every week where it's easy to understand what the message is. And that's why it's great for children to watch when they're growing up and they're developing their sense of right and wrong.
Yeah. Even the episodes that are tech heavy are morality plays.
Absolutely.
Like, you know,
Ultimate Computer is a morality play.
Yeah. Or even in Next Gen, the episode where they're... where the warp bubble is making that passageway of space unusable.
Yep.
And it's an you know, environmental story. Mm-hmm. Or cause and effect with the time loops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just problem solving, even if you don't quite understand the science, you know, behind it.
I don't think of it as a show that is difficult for people to understand and that intellectuals will glom onto, even though it has that strange reputation from people who aren't fans. It's smarter. It's smart.
Right.
But it's not lofty, and it's not. It's a pulp adventure story where people punch each other and there are lasers.
Right.
Like it's yeah. That's what's fun about it when you're first getting into it. But then right. You start to see what the references are, the episode titles having Shakespearean references,
sure.
Or all of these things.
It is not. It is rarely quote unquote hard science fiction.
Right.
It occasionally dips its toe. When it does get complex, particularly in Deep Space Nine, is with the breadth of the characters, mm-hmm. The gray areas between good and evil, the Dominion War, was Sisko right to delete the file and in the pale moonlight and let Garak, let the Romulan ambassador get killed? That's something that's debatable. But that's just that's a storytelling. That has nothing to do with science,
right.
Really. Once you get past the fact that the founders are goo, and the Bajorans have a Pog, and there's Pa Wraiths in the fire caves and all that. Once you get past all that, it's just storytelling.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. I mean, I think the closest that it ever got to hard science fiction is Motion Picture, which is one of people's least favorite pieces of Star Trek. But it's okay. My favorite, besides Next Generation, it's my favorite movie. Straight up, it's my favorite movie.
Star Trek The Motion Picture is your favorite movie?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Wow. I mean, it's I love it.
I went to a thrift store in Pasadena. And got a Star Trek The Motion Picture crew jacket.
Oh, wow.
It's the original crew jacket that they gave everybody. It's gold.
Oh, wow.
I only know it's the original because, who sold it? It wasn't Roddenberry, but it was Roddenberry, his assistant. Who was Roddenberry's assistant?
Richard Arnold.
No. The one that he was...
DC Fontana?
No, the one that he was having the affair
oh,
with.
Oh, well, I will not say on this show, but...
So someone who had a connection to Roddenberry was selling it, and I was like, well, that's the jacket that I have, and it's amazing that I have it, but it's my favorite. But it's the only one that's, like, actually cerebral and unpleasant to watch if you're not interested.
We did a whole podcast on it with Screen Crushes. Matt Singer and I sat down, and we talked about it for a bit. I love the movie... Have you seen Robert Wise's version of the Andromeda Strain?
Yes.
Okay. There are a lot of similarities visually mm-hmm. between the two, I think. If you love hallways and color saturation.
Absolutely, I do.
And, the Andromeda Strain, which I brought it up in that other episode, and the feedback from listeners was, I haven't seen that. I'm like, you've got to see it. This is a movie, let's say it's 2 hours long. The first 80 minutes are about a guy taking the elevator down.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes forever for him to get to where he needs to go. I mean, there's a lot of flashbacks, and there's like scenes of him scrubbing up and going through all these different.
That was
ways.
The book, though. That was the book. So much of that book was the minutia of how this base, this underground
yeah.
base, works, and how they're going to stop this virus. It wasn't a sexy story.
No,
and I think that's the case with Motion Picture too. It wasn't a sexy.
They're
story.
Going to this thing.
Yeah,
and then along the way, Spock is going to realize that human connection is important.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
And it's a beautiful story when you see it that way, and you see these characters sort of shaking themselves out of this techno stupor and remembering that like they're people.
Yeah,
because you've been out in space so long, you forgot you're a human
yeah.
being.
I love that movie. I want to see it again in 70mm. They occasionally flop. It goes around to like
yeah.
Places like Moving Image Museum in New York, and it really is wonderful and very different. It's
yeah.
very different from everything else in Star Trek. And have you read the book? Have you read Roddenberry's?
Yes, I have.
it's
something else.
Yeah, no, it's
but
cool stuff.
I think that's. It's funny that that's the first movie, but that's less approachable than The Man Trap.
Yeah. Because
you would think the first aired episode of Star Trek, maybe that's not as accessible because it's the TV show and it was playing to a specific audience, whereas it's the first movie, so it has to be a big, broad pop culture spectacle, and it wasn't.
We are, in a way, very lucky that the movie's a little bit of a miracle. It shouldn't exist. And case in point, they never let Roddenberry that close
Correct.
To another movie again. It's a very Roddenberry movie. The first season of TNG is very Roddenberry. He's a very very earnest, very...
It was up front. It was never
yeah.
trying to fool you.
No.
The episodes... Mantrap is another one where it's like this straightforward storytelling of there's a mystery, we solve the mystery, here's the moral of the story. That was TV writing back then.
Yeah.
And you know, Next Generation was more sophisticated in a lot of ways, but it was still that Roddenberry template of this is Encounter at Farpoint is another alien mystery. The alien is not what it seems.
Yeah.
That was a trope, and that you go back to Mantrap, and it's and The Cage. The Cage is about an alien that is not what it seems, or a person that is not what it seems.
And that's what V'ger is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something that's really cool that you see in Mantrap that is discussed a lot in all of Star Trek lore, and you rarely see, and I was hoping you'd see it in Star Trek Beyond, and you didn't, and there was a great opportunity, is Spock's green blood.
Yep.
You green-blooded Vulcan. There's very little actual green blood in any of Star Trek. You get some good views of Klingon purple blood in Star Trek VI. But in Patterns of Force, when the Nazis are whipping Kirk and Spock and they're shirtless, you get to see some green bruises. And in Star Trek Beyond, Spock's got like a tube, a pipe coming out of his belly, and Bones whips it out. I thought for sure that you get to see a lot of good green blood in that. Not in Star Trek 09, you see a little green blood on the kid's lip.
Yeah.
But in this, you get to see some nice green blood, which also was great for a first episode because
it establishes that he is different.
Yeah.
Another piece of him being different. Because, I mean, the ears already.
The ears. And then he mentions also when the vampire, when the salt vampire tries to kill him, he's like, well, my Vulcan physiognomy means that I have less.
He has less salt in his body.
Less salt.
And so he's not an appealing meal for the M113 salt vampire.
Oh, man. Exactly. Exactly. So something else shocking for its time is the big ending. You've got Kirk, our hero, William Shatner, matinee star, leading man, slapping a woman across the face. Now, she's not really a woman. She's the salt vampire.
But she is a female she is a female of her species, correct? Or is she not? Is that established? I can't remember.
I don't know if that's established or not.
See, we cannot discriminate against women of any species. Right. Okay? She's a she and don't hurt
She me. Might be a she. I mean, you know, but it's funny because earlier Sulu admonishes Janice Rand for calling the plant Beauregard a she. And he's like, why do they always call a ship a she? And then she's like, Beauregard's a he, I can tell. And it's just a hand.
Yep.
It's a purple hand in a plant thing. And it looks silly, but it's great. I love that. I mean, that's part of that whole, like, you know. No, is the Mantrap alien a she? Well, maybe listeners will let us know.
Oh, they will let us know all the things we got wrong today.
But the optic, as they say these days, is he's slapping a woman across the face, which for 1966, which is not necessarily a good thing. You know, I'm not saying this is something that we need more of in television, men slapping women. But I'm just saying back then especially, that was like, holy shit, you don't show that on television.
No.
And, you know, but
well, if a woman was in some way hysterical, like the
calm
hysteria,
her down.
I gotta shake her, I gotta slap her. So there was that element of it, but yeah, I mean, it's as shocking today. It's more it should be more shocking today than it was back then because we don't. That's just something that we frown upon in this society, and rightfully so. This sort of idea of like, you know, a strong man beating up a woman,
yeah,
you know, it's crazy.
And then, of course, she beats the hell out of Spock. I mean, Spock's, you know, she just shoves him and he goes and knocks the books off the shelf.
Right.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
So what was your ultimate takeaway when you say you watched it again just a few hours ago?
I did, man.
What was your, if you have a summing up on the Mantrap, what was sort of your ultimate takeaway on this?
My ultimate takeaway of the episode is that it works. It's not a great episode. It doesn't have a brilliant idea behind it the way that Corbomite Maneuver does, where it's, again, an alien who's not what it seems.
Right. Well, I guess the real question is, what episodes are not that?
Well, any episode with the Klingons, they're always what they seem.
Right.
They're always bad guys until Next Generation.
Yeah.
It's a fun episode. I don't recommend people start there.
Right.
Just because it's not... it's a simplistic story.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know who the bad guy is. You don't know the extent to what they to what she is, but you know that she is not good.
Yeah.
But it's fun in the context of the first season of Star Trek. It's a Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
You watch The Cage. If you start at The Cage, you don't know what Star Trek is. It's so out there, yeah. And there's very little stuff on the bridge once the away team comes down to try to shoot the cave open again. It's all in these weird dream worlds, and it's taking you to places that you don't understand. What are these Orion slave girl or Orion women? Because we don't say slave girls anymore because it's sexist. But we, nobody knows what that is. So Mantrap at least is Star Trek. It's still not quite Star Trek. By the middle of the season, I think it's Star Trek again.
Yeah.
But it's a fine. I mean, it's not amazing. That's what I really. That's my final takeaway. It's like it's fine.
They had sort of painted themselves into a corner. I don't think anybody on the production staff was happy that it was the first one to go out.
Oh no!
It was just sort of they fell into it, mostly because Corbomite Maneuver had too many special effects, and the third party company they'd hired out kind of said, yeah, we can get a few by Friday, no problem. And then they're like, it took them months.
That's the amazing thing about the entire first season of Star Trek, is it's. In my opinion, the best season. I know there are people that would ride or die for season two, and there are a lot of great episodes of season two. Season one is the best season.
I agree. And I think for TOS, season one is the best.
Always behind.
Yeah.
Constantly behind.
This is a theme in Star Trek, is that it is always chasing a train, and they're always a mess, production-wise. Star Trek Discovery is supposed to launch in a couple of months, really? When you think about it, in January.
And they don't even have the ships
on
not
CBS
ready,
All Access. From what they haven't announced the cast, we haven't seen the damn thing, they haven't started shooting. It'll be great, but that's because that's Star Trek. It's always got to be a mess, you know? Yeah. And sometimes it bites them in the rear end. Star Trek V would have been better if Shatner was able to shoot those rock monsters, I think. The story would have still been a bit of a mess.
Star Trek Beyond was a movie that they had to, you know, sort of like reconsider reconfigure.
They had to ash can the first script, and then for the betterment of, the more I think about Star Trek Beyond, I'm very pleased with it.
It's a great film. I was at the Comic-Con premiere, and you see it on this big IMAX screen, and an orchestra playing the score. It was remarkable, and you know, I hope that there are many more with that crew, because they put together an amazing cast.
I do too, and you know, that's the word, is that they're going to do it, and then the box office returns were fine. Mm-hmm. Some are saying it's a flop. It's not a flop. It's fine. It's a base hit, as they say. But it just opened in China, you know. So maybe, I mean, who knows? They say they're going to do a fourth one. I asked Doug Young and Simon Pegg, who have both been on the show, if they'd like to write the script, and they very diplomatically said, well, the other guys are great guys, too.
They hired some people.
Yeah, they were the guys who wrote the first script for Bob Orsi that got nixed.
Payne and McKay.
Yeah, and they both said it was not the script's fault. It was, you know, they're great, you know. So the ball's with those two guys now. But personally, I mean, I think there's some magic in Young and Pegg's script and Justin Lin directing. I would love to see those three back together.
And where they have some time, because, you know, as with the original series and as with a lot of Star Trek, they were under the gun.
But maybe not. Maybe that's the magic.
Maybe. Wrath of Khan, being the best one to most people's minds, had, you know, some of the smallest budget.
Yeah. Maybe being under the gun. I mean, look, Casablanca is considered one of the best movies of all time, if not the best. That was the most troubled production ever. They had no idea what they were doing on that movie. They didn't have an ending.
Yeah.
They showed up for work on the last day. What do we shoot? I don't know. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, sometimes that magic works. Not always. Take a look at Suicide Squad.
Sure.
That's a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work, but maybe for Star Trek it does.
Yeah, just, like, you know, you read those stories in These Are the Voyages about Roddenberry feverishly rewriting scripts at the last minute while they were on the soundstage shooting the episode.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. It's magic,
yeah.
And that's the thing that I get from the Mantrap more than anything, is Star Trek is a magical thing, and that all of these people came together to create this thing that 50 years later is still something that touches people's heart and their mind and fires their imagination. It's great. There's nothing better than Star Trek.
Yeah, it's half a century old, this episode, and although there are some corny moments, like those lines I talked about, it still fundamentally works. Mm-hmm. You could still watch it as a newcomer and be like, oh, this is a lot of fun. Before we let you go, Star Trek Beyond, which as of this recording, we're still don't know too much about. As I mentioned last week, you know, there's going to be leaks. You know, we're going to know news soon. I mean, I know they're going to try to make a formal announcement. But I'm just curious what your hopes are for the show.
For Discovery?
Yeah. What did I say? I meant Beyond. Discovery.
That's okay.
What are your hopes for the show? What do you want to see? What are you most excited about? What are you worried about?
This is an interesting question. Because this is the first Star Trek television series to premiere since I became a writer, journalist, lived in Hollywood,
Right. Met
people that have been on Star Trek.
You're going to be on it.
Me? No.
No, I mean you're going to be on the beat.
Oh, on the beat. Yeah, sure. Sorry. You meant I was going to be in the show.
No, you're going to be on the show.
Congratulations. Today we are announcing that you are the captain. You're the captain now. Yeah, it's the first time that I've ever had that access or that connection to the entertainment industry. I mean, I'm doing the official Star Trek podcast, and you're asking me about a Star Trek TV show that's coming out in a few months. So it's a weird feeling to wonder what it's going to be, find out some, you know, little bits and pieces of information here and there, and speculate on it as not only a fan but as a professional. I just want it to be good. I really like the design of the ship. Yeah. I immediately was like tweeting about how it looked like the Ralph McQuarrie design.
Yeah, you were one of the first, actually.
Because one of my favorite Star Trek books of all time is Star Trek Phase Two: The Lost Series by the Reeve Stevenses.
Yes.
And that design always intrigued me because it was McQuarrie and it was a movie that never happened. It was for Planet of Titans.
Yeah, I want to give you official credit. You may not have been the first on the world, but you were the first person I saw to make the connection to McQuarrie on Twitter. I mean, instantly. So
yeah, that's
big ups, as they say, because I was just looking at it going like, it looks like a triangle. What's going on? And you're like, no, refer to your Phase 2 book. Go to page 6.
Yeah, but that, you know, goes back to my love of the motion picture and all that stuff. I'm interested in the idea that the lead is not going to be the captain this time.
I know. That's the bigger, that's total mind-blowing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge because the captain is always the lead. That's just how Star Trek works. Yeah. It was always weird to me that Commander Sisko was the lead on Deep Space Nine because he wasn't a captain. So when Picard shows up in The Emissary and he's subservient to Picard, it's like, whoa, this guy is different than the typical Star Trek lead actor.
And then he punches Q and says, I'm not Picard.
Yeah, exactly. It was a different kind of show. Yeah. So I'm intrigued by that. I'm intrigued by the time frame that they're putting it in. It's sort of before the original series.
Post-Enterprise, pre-TOS. I will admit that I have mixed feelings about that.
Interesting.
I would prefer if it was like what's next, you know, like the last thing to happen in official Star Trek in any filmed version, putting the books aside, is Spock went through the wormhole and went to the Kelvin universe. Mm-hmm. You know,
and Romulus has been destroyed.
Yeah. It's post Nemesis. Admiral Janeway's on Earth, and Spock was working with the Romulans, and he went through the wormhole, and that's it. You know, my ultimate fantasy would be the very first shot of this new show would be some monitor of watching Spock's ship go in and be like, well, Godspeed, Mr. Spock. On to today's business.
That happened.
And then just continue. But this is the choice that they made. And
I think that there's a lot of creative pushback against the idea of doing more stuff in the Prime Universe going into the future because so much has happened. Right, so you've come up. Transwarp drive exists. You understand the Borg's network of tubes,
the transwarp corridors.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Is what they're called.
Yeah, okay. Species 8472, and all of these sorts of things that render the universe less mysterious. You've seen everything. You've seen the Dominion War, and you've seen you know, all kinds of weird episodes with anomalies and coming up with ways to change the shield modulation to do this thing and that thing. And so you'd have to unravel all of that. and either unravel it or ignore it to make sure that you had enough tools to tell a good story.
You mean for newcomers to come in?
No, I mean just in terms of like the history of it and what can the phasers do? What can the deflector dish do? It's all been pushed so far, and Jordy or B'Elanna Torres or whoever has done so many weird things to it to save the ship that all of those mission logs should be available for the next captain of the Enterprise. And when they don't reference that stuff, then it's you start scratching your head as an audience member, as a fan who remembers that episode of Voyager or that Deep Space Nine arc or that TNG where they go to the planet on the Justice planet.
Right,
or
right.
Whatever.
So what you're saying to me is very interesting. Let me see if I'm interpreting this right. What you're saying is, in a way, by continuing the timeline, the writers will be a little bit boxed in by the history.
Yes.
Because some viewers will have an allegiance to what we saw, what B'Elanna Torres did, whereas a newcomer doesn't really watch Voyager, doesn't remember. It was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a bit of a conflict between
that.
Yeah,
why didn't they solve this problem the way that Geordi solved it, or the way that Data solved it, or whatever?
So by going back a little bit to a point in the timeline that is, you know, a little blank, that's still cool and in the Prime universe, but hasn't been touched, and is in that interzone between Enterprise and TOS where we can still do new things without the technology that's been shown to death in the 90s and early 2000s, even though it's back in time, it's still a wider explore.
And you also don't have to deal with the fact that, you know, there's replicators or there's the holodeck. The technology advanced so far in Star Trek that it, I think, for the casual audience started to feel like magic.
Well, that's what Arthur C. Clarke would say, too.
Right, yeah. It's like, oh, you can do anything on this. On this
I've never been the biggest fan of the holodeck or the replicator. I always felt like cheating a little bit. I mean, it started off with, let's get a cup of tea, and then it's like, you can do anything with it.
Yeah,
so.
It's so utopian and so perfect for some people that they want to go back to the time when it was still sort of rough and tumble. That was the idea behind Enterprise.
Yeah, you know, you're making a really interesting case because I think this is probably the problem that when they sat down and said, what are we going to do? We got the property. CBS said, go, Mr. Fuller, what do you want to do? And he probably said, probably had thoughts similar to what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's too limiting to be at the end of to be the next chapter in so much stuff. So to go back a little bit to this point where there's not a lot of information known is more freeing.
And
in
you
a
can
way.
Still play with the iconography of the original series, but tweak it slightly because we haven't seen that interim period other than the cage. Like I would hope that those sweaters come back.
Yeah.
I love those sweaters. I was expecting
Yeoman Cult. I loved Yeoman Cult.
I was expecting the sweaters in the beginning prologue of the first new Star Trek movie. In
right.
The timeline. Like, where are the sweaters?
Yeah.
why does that guy look kind of like Captain Picard?
Right. Well, you know, it's you know, who knows which characters. I mean, there's a theory right now that this lead character is gonna be number one.
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
I think it would be strange to recast Majel Barrett.
No, I don't think they can. I don't think it's going to be that. There's also there's a lot of if you connect the dots, there's a lot of thinking that it'll be a woman of color in the lead. It's just because Fuller slipped.
Angela Bassett was who he wanted to be the captain.
He mentioned that, but then he also mentioned that was a long time ago. Though.
Yeah, that was a long time.
And then he mentioned recently at Comic-Con that he had had a chat with Mae Jemison, the African-American astronaut. And what he said, and we played it on this show, he said to talk to her about the he corrected himself. He almost said the character.
Yeah.
And then he stopped. He said, you know, the show or the you know, whatever. So that would be awesome.
Yeah.
And I think is probably the case. So, maybe she was a captain. This is what I'm thinking. She is. It's because he said she's a lieutenant commander of sorts. I think the actual word he used was with caveats. That's what he said. Lieutenant commander with caveats. Episode one, she's the captain. She screws up. She gets demoted.
Right.
And this show is about her busting her hump, for a new captain on a new ship, trying to get her act together back after her screw up. Maybe her screw up was like a battle where a lot of people died. Who knows? I mean, that's, you know, to see that psychological impact is something you really rarely see on Star Trek. So
yeah, and there's also the rumor that it's a Section 31 show.
No, he killed that.
Oh, he did.
Fuller
that.
Said that's not the case.
Okay,
well, he said it's not the Kobayashi Maru. Mm-hmm. It's not Section 31. And it's not, which it could never be the Kobayashi Maru, because that would have been hundreds of years ago, not 10 years ago. And then he said it's not the Battle of Axinar. So, yeah, who knows? But
I'm fascinated by what it's going to be. I'm excited. I just want it to be the sort of thoughtful science fiction that it can be. You know, I don't want it to be the kinds of things you see on the CW. Sorry, CW. But your shows are great. It's just that the shows are not hard science fiction.
No. The Flash is good, though.
They're good. I'm not saying they're bad shows. Mm-hmm. They're good shows. It's just that they're a different kind of fantasy genre programming. I don't want that. I want it to be as Star Trek-y as possible, but not to go into a realm of it being too dark. I think we need an optimistic story. I think we need Roddenberry's vision now more than ever, and I wrote about that in The Guardian a few months ago. This is incredibly important at this time in our culture.
I'm hoping it's too much not like Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
Which was a great show.
Yeah.
It got a little wonky in the middle there, but I still think it's great, and I even like the last episode, which few people like. Mm-hmm. But that was of its time. That was very 2003, 2004, or whenever that came out.
It was post 9/11 period. Yeah.
So and I don't want it to be that. I don't think it will, though. I don't think that's Fuller's style.
I don't think so either.
But when they say it's 13 episodes and they're all connected and there's like an edge of your seat aspect to it, I hope it's not like BSG.
I think we're in for a very good show. I think Brian Fuller is a real fan.
Yeah.
And he's very much, I think, concerned with the legacy. More so than I think a lot of people even realize yet.
Yeah, he'll lose sleep if he screws up one of his other shows, because he's got a lot of fingers in the pie. If he screws up American Gods, he'll live, you know?
That's he screws up show. Star Trek.
Like, through Star Trek, he's
well. I mean, you get that sense from Justin Lin and from Simon Pegg too, of like they understood how important it was to nail this movie, and they did. And so, whenever there's a fan involved, I trust them to at least respect the canon and respect the vibe.
But also good that he's got Nick Meyer as a consultant, because Nick Meyer's not a fan,
right? But he does understand Star Trek.
He understands it, but he does not come at it like it's a sacred text. Right. He's like, change that.
And here are the reasons why this is a bad idea. Right. Here's why you should put a no smoking sign on the bridge of the Enterprise. Because you never know when Spock might light up a cigarette.
Well, listen, on that note, I want to say thanks so much. This was a lengthy episode, but I think we did the man trap the service it needs. Dave Schilling, we can find you on Twitter where?
At Dave_Schilling.
You use an underscore.
I do.
All right, good.
Yes.
And your writing is exclusively in The Guardian these days? Or
I write periodically for the Birth, Movies, Death magazine. I actually wrote for the Star Trek issue.
So did I.
Oh, great. I did see that. Yeah, I wrote about the motion picture. Well, what did you write about?
I wrote a little bit about Roddenberry in general.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's funny. The two we only write on the same publication.
It seems like it, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So cool. So if you don't follow Dave on Twitter, you should read him in The Guardian, which you should be doing anyway. And thanks so much, and we will see you all soon. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.